And so the first leg of this pathway we call exegesis, our exegetical work. And this instruction is part of that process. Structure is one of the things that you want to pay attention to. In fact, we would argue one of the main things you want to pay attention to in your exegetical work. The place to start is by affirming that Scripture is rational discourse. Even though I mentioned earlier today that it is qualitatively different than all other rational discourse you'll encounter, still, God has accommodated himself to the structures of human consciousness and the structures of human communication. And so what we have here is not something outside of human ability to apprehend. This is rational discourse. He means us to understand it, so he's accommodated himself to what he knows best, because he built it into human being, rationality. And so Scripture is rational discourse. It proceeds. It's not random. It's not nonsense. It's rational discourse, and it proceeds as rational discourse proceeds. Let me boil it down this way. I know this is a bit of an oversimplification, but rational discourse consists in two parts. An idea, you can maybe think in terms of a concept, and its development. Now, I know that's, I'm trying to purposely boil things down, but that's what rational discourse is. It's an idea, a concept, and its development, the development that the author uses to communicate his idea. And so we could speak of the author's argument. And structure is a property of your text. You're going to hear me, probably the other guys, use this phrase, maybe in your small groups. One of the things that you want to develop is the ability to detect identifiable properties of your text. That's what you're doing in exegesis. Lexical properties, syntactical properties, contextual properties. One of the properties of your text is its structure. It's a big one, but we can think of it in terms of a property of your text. And it's a property of your text that carries or represents the development, the argument of your passage. So what we're after here is, how has the author organized his thoughts? What structure has he used to develop his idea, his concept, the claim that he's making? The assumption we're operating on here is that within every text there is a structure giving some shape and some order to the material of your text. So a moment ago, Ben gave us this diagram of this skeleton. This guy doesn't have any flesh on his body. It's just his bones. That's the little image that we use to talk about this principle of structure. Beneath the surface of every passage, there is this underlying arrangement, structure, organization. Now, let me just pause here, and there's going to be a few places where we got to just do a little sidebar. This is one of them. This is assuming that you have identified what we'll call a rational unit. We can get ourselves into a lot of trouble if we're trying to find structure and we're straddling units. So this assumes you have identified a rational unit. How do you identify a unit? Well, when there's a discernible beginning and end. And by discernible, I mean you can point to specific properties of your text and say, this is where it starts, this is where it ends. So the Gospel of Mark has a discernible beginning and a discernible end. It's a rational unit. You could preach the Gospel of Mark in one sermon. It has something that holds it together, a unifying theme, and it has a structure. Mark is also made up of units, identifiable units. So, by the way, we'll be using examples. You saw this in Ben's talk. We'll be using examples from the Gospels generally. Part of the reason for that is we don't want to be using as examples up here the texts that you guys are working on. Some of you might wish we would. Maybe later in the course of the workshop we might, but for now let me have you turn to John chapter 9. What I'm trying to stress here is this idea of making sure that you are identifying a rational unit. So John chapter 9, actually look at the last moment of John chapter 8. So they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. As he passed by, he saw a man. So you have a very clear shift there, marking, at least initially, marking, there seems like there's something new here. Change of time, change of place. And look what it says in 9:1. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from his birth. Now look over at the last moment of chapter 9. Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say we see, your guilt remains. And then the next thing you read is about the shepherd. It has nothing to do with blindness. So when you identify, now obviously they've given you a chapter division. Chapter 9 holds together for a reason. It's chapter 9 for a reason. But even if you didn't have the chapter markings, you would know, oh, I see that beginning, blind man, end. Are we blind too? All the stuff in between hangs together on that theme of blindness. The minute I go outside of that, I'm talking about a shepherd or I'm talking about something else before. I've identified there are specific properties of the text I can point to identify I've got a unit here. So as soon as we identify a unit like that, we can say with confidence that text has a structure. There is something to that unit. There's a development of the idea and the concept that John's trying to communicate. So, by the way, on the basis of that, notice the importance of text selection as part of your exegetical work, making sure that you identify a rational unit. Within every text, there is a structure which represents the author's development, which gives shape to the material of your passage. Fair enough? Within every text, I think you can operate with confidence here because Scripture is rational discourse. Within every text, there is a structure which represents the author's development and which gives shape to the material of your passage. And one of the very important tasks in your working of your text, in your exegetical work, is to detect and describe that structure. That's what you're doing in those 5 hours on Monday. Part of what you're doing in those 5 hours on Monday to understand your text. You want to detect and describe that structure. You're asking the question, how has the author organized his material? In fact, let me just back up a moment before I kind of give you the formal statement of the principle here. This is going to come up probably a couple of times during the course of our time together, but let me just, for the sake of our present discussion, talk about 5 steps in your sermon preparation process, okay? This is, again, a little sidebar. Step number 1, we call your text work. That's you doing this stuff. Step number 2, I like to call your secondary reading. That's when you're pulling your commentaries or whatever supplemental helps. You're not notice the order here, very important. Your text work is you with your Bible and your notebook. And that's it. Now, I recognize this can be frustrating because you might spend, who knows, 6 to 8 hours here, and you end up at destination X in understanding your text, and then you open your commentary on the Gospel of John, you read Carson's commentary, and look, there it is, X. And you feel good for a moment. You think, oh, I got it. And then you realize, I just spent 6 to 8 hours. I could have just read that text. Why did I spend all that time? Well, you know why you spent that time. Because there is a work that God needs to do in you, and you're not going to be a faithful, pardon my sentimentality here, on fire preacher if the work hasn't done its work in you. So don't deprive yourself and your people by reading commentaries first, men. The reason why you read commentaries is maybe a little bit to check your answers or to find some answer to a question. The main reason why you read commentaries is to enter into conversation with somebody else who's thought carefully about your text, to refine your thinking, to help you gain what we call articulate knowledge. You know what happens when you talk to somebody else about something that matters? It helps you clarify your thinking. So now you sit down with Don Carson or whoever you're going to read, and you help clarify, solidify the work that you did in your text work. This is like 2 hours at the most. It's a common rookie error to spend way too much time reading commentaries in your sermon prep. Number three, and you do your, what's step number three? Your homiletical structuring. So this is where you're starting to do some of this work, this persuasion, crafting work. Your fourth step is writing. You're actually sitting down and fulfilling a clear sermonic argument to deliver to your people. I used to dread this because it's really hard work. It requires careful attention and focus. I love it now. It's my favorite part of sermon prep. It's the place now where I most experience the provision of the Spirit of God, even to the giving of words and ideas. Guys, your sermon preparation should be an experience of communion with God. And this is one of the places for me that I treasure in that light. And then number five, you're familiarizing. This is, again, your writing for me is 3 hours. The structuring is about 1 hour. Familiarizing is, you know, maybe 2 hours. The whole point of familiarizing is so that you're not up here giving your primary attention to your manuscript. You're familiar enough with it, you can give your primary attention to your people. Those of you who have been around before, you've heard me say this. Preaching is an act of love. Fundamentally, preaching is an act of love, and this is serving your people. You're doing this because you care about them and you want them to not be distracted by your overdependence on notes or your failure to get your ideas straight. That's my understanding of your job with sermon preparation. Now let's blow this thing up right here, your text work, because I want to focus here on three steps of text work. So inside of step number one of sermon preparation is three steps of text work. Number one, you're going to determine the primary claim of the text. This is all going to come back around to structure in a minute, guys. I'm trying to give you a larger frame. You're going to determine the primary claim of your text. Second, you're going to describe the development of the text. And then third, you will make significant exegetical observations. Let me just unpack what I mean by that real quick. Let's just say, for sake of argument, you've got your text, John 9. You've identified it's a unit. It's a clear beginning, clear ending. Now you look at your text and you identify, for sake of argument, 100 properties of your text. How many of those are you going to comment on in your sermon? Can't do them all. The ideal of a commentary is to comment on everything. The ideal of a sermon is to be selective in order to help you accomplish the communication of this, the primary claim. So a significant exegetical observation is one that's going to help you advance the claim of the text, and you're going to get about 8 of them in your sermon. And you have to decide which of the 100 observations you can make about your text are going to be most useful in your sermon in advancing the claim of the text now upon your people. What's interesting is if you get these right, if you choose the right ones, and if you resist the impulse to talk about this one just because you happen to know about it, or because you think it's going to make you look clever, if you choose these right ones, you'll shine the light on everything else in the text, and you won't have to comment on everything. The lights will come on in the house. And because you've been disciplined and careful. I like this image. You know those thermal photographs where they show you the hot spots of a body or the hot spots of a house? You have to develop the ability to look at your text that way and to identify what are the hot spots here? What are the things? And how do you figure that out? By asking, do they have an immediacy in helping me communicate the primary claim? Now, there's an order to this, but it doesn't work out in your study as neat and tidy as all this. Because you know why? Because you got to do some of this work and this work in order to have confidence about this. So even though this is the first thing you're after and you're keeping it in your mind, I don't want to get lost in the trees. I'm looking for the forest right now. I still have got to look at some specific trees to figure out what forest I'm in. Does that make sense? So I know I put this sequentially. It represents priority, but it doesn't represent temporal sequence in your study. You just got to keep this in mind. Now, all of that to say, what we're talking about here is this second step of your text work where you are seeking to describe the way the author organized his passage, the way the author organized his text. Here's the principle. Every text has a structure. Structure will reveal emphasis. Or to use our language here, every text has a development. Your description of that development is going to help you ascertain the primary claim of the text, the emphasis of the text. So let me say the principle again. Every text has a structure. Structure will reveal emphasis, which, by the way, is going to end up being the emphasis of your sermon. You can see the line we're trying to draw here. We don't want you preaching over there or on this side thing of the text. We want you on the main line of the text. And using the tool, the exegetical tool of structure, is going to help you get at the main line of the text. At least that's what we're arguing. Now, it might go without saying, but it's a very important thing to note that different text types have different structural patterns. By the way, don't confuse. That is just a mess. Don't confuse. When I use the language of text type, don't confuse that with what we sometimes talk about as genre. So genre is a much bigger category. Text type is talking about the specific kind of dynamics of a particular text. So genre is a bigger category. It typically speaks about the nature of the book. Give me some genres. Yeah, it's a tough one. Just give me something else. Say it again. Apocalyptic. Gospel. What a... Okay, poetry, I'm just going to hold off on for a second. Say it again. Narrative. I'm going to hold off on a second. Epistle, law, good, history, prophecy. You see what we're getting at here. We're talking about the nature of a book. The reason why this can sometimes be a little tricky is because some of these things, let's just use this one for example, apocalyptic. What kind of text types are inside apocalyptic? Poetry, narrative, discourse. So we typically think about three text types: narrative, discourse, this is like speech, teaching, and poetry. And what we're arguing is that these three text types, now again, there's various arguments about this, but this will represent all of the types of texts. But sometimes all three of these show up, and guess what? It's true in our Gospels. All three of these show up. Now, not as much in Mark as in John or Matthew. You know, both of those have these long discourses. We got one discourse in Mark. I mean, there's a few other places where there's obviously speech, but chapter 13, the Olivet Discourse, there's an extended discourse there. But Mark is, of the Gospels, the most, I'm going to make up a word here, I think, narratively dense. It's the most consistently narrative. So what's the point here? Each of those different text types is going to exhibit a different kind of structural pattern or different kind of structural strategies. So for example, discourse. Typically, your structure follows a pattern of logical development. So what do you look for when you're doing structural analysis of discourse? You look for steps, especially how they were related to each other. So syntactical clues become hugely important in determining the structure of discourse. What about narrative? Which we're going to be dealing with a lot of narrative texts. Well, narrative structure comes with some plot development. So we're looking for development that carries the story along a plot line. Now, I want to share something with you, put it up on the board, walk through one example, and then give you some group work to do, and then we're going to follow it with a warning. So I just want you to know now there's a warning coming. But let me just illustrate or share with you this structural tool that you can use with a high degree of productivity in narrative. You've probably seen something like it before. Usually it's like in our high school lit classes that we get introduced to this. It's something called the plot line, or sometimes you'll see this described as the narrative arc. And there's parts to this that we can label. Usually it starts, do you guys know this? Help me fill it out. First thing?
Setting.
Where typically there's a place or a time, a situation. Next? Say it again.
Rising action.
So this is where the story starts. Something happens in the narrative where some specific thing happens. And usually in this rising action, you've got some conflict or some tension of some sort. It's what makes a story interesting, makes us go, what's going to happen? And then next,
climax.
And this is where there something happens, some turning point or some revelation of some sort. And then what?
Resolution.
Sometimes you hear it as falling action. I like this word, resolution. And then last, sometimes we think of this as a new setting. But please notice in this drawing, this is higher than this. In other words, this episode in Mark's gospel is part of a much larger narrative arc, and this little episode advanced the arc overall. Because we could do this on the whole gospel of Mark. But when you identify a unit, this is one of the tools in narrative. It's a structure. You're observing how the author developed his idea, his concept. So let's try it out. Let's go to John chapter 2. John chapter 2, fairly familiar story. I'm going to walk through this real quick. You might disagree with my exact divisions. Let's not get hung up on that, okay? That's an appeal for grace to your speaker. By the way, you're going to find this with a high degree of application to a passage, which, by the way, has the very same reference numbers as this, chapter 2, verses 1 through 12, except we're in John's gospel. I just want to tell you, this has a huge payoff for another passage with similar designations. Look at your text. I'm going to walk you through this one first, and then I'm going to give you one to work on as your team. Okay, John chapter 2. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee. Do you see what it's saying? It's giving you a setting. And the mother of Jesus was there. Now it's given us part of the setting. Who's there? Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, see that? All of a sudden the story is starting. So now in the setting, John chapter 2, we've got verses 1 and 2. And all of a sudden now there's some action, which introduces some conflict, some tension. We're at a wedding and the wine ran out. So at least we know this starts at verse 3. Now, there's going to be some argument about how far the rising action goes. But the point is you've identified a move. There's something structurally that you identified using this plot line thing so that you're into now the rising action. I'm going to argue that that rising action goes all the way to verse 8. It's describing the story, the unfolding of the story. And that something happens in verse 9 that we, and by the way, this tension is happening on two different levels. You got tension about the wine, and you got tension between Jesus and his mother, which, by the way, is really important to a theme in the Gospel of John about what it means to be the Messiah. Because don't forget what John was writing about. I wrote this so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ. And so here's now John in the very first miracle telling us something about what it means to be the Christ in this little interaction between Jesus and his mom. John is the most literally beautiful, I think, of all of the books of the New Testament, rivaled only by Job in the Old Testament. So many layers in the Gospel of John. You should be thankful Mark's not quite as sophisticated. So we get to the climax, and then I'm going to argue the resolution. So the climax, verse 9, where are we here? When the master of the feast tasted the water now become wine. He didn't know where it came from. The other guys did. The master of the feast called the bridegroom. Now look at what happens in verses 10 and 11. Everyone who serves the good wine first, and when the people have drunk freely, then the poor wine, but you've kept the good wine until now. This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory. His disciples believed in him. So there's, again, just give me some space to work here. I'm going to argue 10 and 11 are the resolution. I'm going to come back to this in a second. And then all of a sudden you got verse 12, brand new setting, but a little higher. We're at a different point than when we came in, right? Now, to the degree that that's accurate, I'm going to argue it's not just fun to do, it's a tool. Don't miss this. It's a tool to help you to determine the emphasis. How does this tool work? I'll come back to you in a half second, Joel. How does this tool work? I would argue that the emphasis typically resides somewhere in here, in the relationship between the climax and what the climax achieves. Joel, don't forget your question. I just want to finish this thought. In this case, how might the application of this tool help you reveal emphasis? If there's some truth to that, what do we see in those verses? What do we find out? Not just that Jesus was powerful, right? It's not just that he could turn something into something else. He didn't turn the jars into palm trees. The content, remember, this is a sign. And John wrote these signs so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ. So there's something here in this sign that tells me something I need to know about what it means to be the Christ. And so when I see that emphasis in this narrative line on the good wine, the fine wine that has come as a result, and it makes me think of places like Amos and Jeremiah and Hosea and Isaiah that talk about one who's going to come and bring into being new realities, really good realities. So it's not just that he's Messiah, but what kind of Messiah he is that John 2 is trying to get done. So don't preach John 2 just saying Jesus is powerful, believe in him. Pick up the sign which this tool pointed you to as an emphasis in the text. Something about good wine, Messiah. Joel, you had a comment or a question. Absolutely, absolutely. So something follows this. We're going to see this in Mark so often. Episode linking to episode, linking to episode. And then you're going to see how three episodes that Mark stacked together form another unit. We'll get there in a second. But yeah, the whole point of this is advancing the total argument of Mark. We're getting somewhere. We're developing. Because by the end of Mark's gospel, he wants you to have been impacted by the whole. So that's a great observation, Joel. Okay, you guys ready to do a little exercise on your own? You see how this works, right? It's, hear me what I say this, it's a tool to use in narrative that will often be highly productive in helping you determine the emphasis. Go to John chapter 4. I've tried to just find manageable passages. John chapter 4, verses 46 through 54. It's the healing of the official's son. Here's what I want you to do, guys. Two things. Write this down. I want you to do two things. Plot this text on the narrative plot line with verse divisions. And then second, answer the question, what does that tell you about the emphasis of the text? Okay? It's not just a fun little exercise. It's a tool to try to get you something. So plot John 4, 46 through 54 on this narrative plot line, and then answer the question, what might that tell you about the emphasis of the text? Work with your partner at your table, two guys together. Did you have a question of clarification there? You're good? Okay, I'll give you like 4 or 5 minutes. All right, you ready? Let's transition from your small group work to doing this all together. I know this is always a dangerous business. We've not yet had fights break out at Simeon Trust workshops, but this is the point. I'm always a little concerned. All right, let's do this a piece at a time. Setting. Verse 46. In its entirety? Someone's saying 46a. Why? Why is that? Which begins what? Tension. There's somebody sick. So you all get that? So please do not be constrained by verse divisions. You got to be attentive to structure. So we notice at 46b, something happens to begin the action. Somebody's sick. Okay? How far do you want to go in your rising action? This is where it's going to get dicey. Anybody want to make a stab? 48, 49, okay. Anybody else? Someone wants to go through 50A. Okay, I want someone to defend their position by means of something in the text. Yes, Danny. What's your position first? You're going to stop at 48.
Right. It seems like when the official came and said, sir, come down before me, it seems like they're working towards something. It seems like we've arrived at some progress toward resolution.
You buying that? No. There are certain guys in this room that I can do this with. Danny's one of them. What, Kirk, your argument? Okay.
So he says your son is healed. We don't actually know, like from the officer standpoint, right. He doesn't know that's happening.
Right.
There's a lot of like tension that still is in the
So where's your verse marker, Kirk?
So rising tension, probably up to the end of 51, the climax being 52.
You buying it?
No.
Tyler? That was less vociferous than the no against Danny. Tyler, you want to get in this game?
Yeah,
What's your position?
So I take the conflict to be essentially 48, Jesus saying, "If you without signs, you won't believe."
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, "Go, your son will live." And so the climax, the question is, will the man take him at his word?
And will he believe?
Right. Yeah. Or will he?
Okay.
Yeah.
So isn't this interesting? There's a parallel here between this episode and the John 2 episode we just looked at. There's two tensions going on here. You got the sickness, will he get healed, and the will he believe, which goes to the question that John's all about. Are they going to recognize something about this guy? Okay, it matters. Jesus is full of compassion. It matters that this guy gets healed. But all of these signs are about a whole lot more than just compassion. Right? So that helps you. Okay, one more. Jeremiah, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
I think it's in 50. I think it might be dangerous to put the climax of somebody other than Jesus here.
Okay.
As a character.
Okay.
And that because 50 is when there's transformation in the situation.
Okay. All right. I'm this is not punting. Okay? I'm glad for the wrestling here. This is the kind of thing you're going to have to wrestle through, but do not think that the effectiveness of this tool depends on absolutely precise determination of these. You've got a ballpark in here of somewhere in 48 and 50, something's going on. Now, I'm not saying we can't be precise. I'm just saying don't get so, you know, locked into this that you miss what is emerging. Okay? Resolution, who wants to take a shot here?
51 to 53.
Okay, that's where I am on it as well. Whoever, who said that? That was really brilliant. although I would say 53A. Yeah, yes, good, 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 good. Okay, and then I'm going to leave 53B to the new setting. Now again, guys, whether or not you come down in exactly these places, doesn't matter right now. What matters is, how did the tool work for you to help you identify the emphasis? I really want to stress this. Don't get caught up in the tools. Use the tools to help you get emphasis. What's the emphasis? Somebody. Be brave. It's got to be more than belief. There's a...
Christ's word.
Okay. About what?
Jesus can help people.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so certainly the emphasis of this is going to have to include the word belief. Is it going to have to include anything else? Yeah.
I would say, will John's readers who believe need a sign of from Jesus, or will they believe like the man?
Okay, so there's something about the sign, and the specific sign here is his power to heal, which demonstrates something about who he is, which calls forth this. I'm getting that. Because of the thing that my structure pointed to. You see how the tool helps you determine emphasis and is going to keep you from preaching this sermon in one of the odd ways that Ben told us to avoid before, about evangelism or about healings by itself. All right. Say it again. Yeah, so recognize we're in John's gospel. So all of this is that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, and believing have life. Now, which of those components of that melodic line is this passage addressing primarily? Who Jesus is. It's demonstrating something about himself that makes him to be the Christ, and what belief looks like. So I don't know that I'm going to go to eternal life as the main thing here. Could I pull it out? Well, it's there pregnant in every one of John's, but it's not the dominant emphasis of the text. Okay, one more, and then we got to wrap this up.
It's a little bit of nuance in the text. Like, before it talks about Cana, brings up the setting of Cana before going back to that.
Yes.
He's not just the Messiah. He's a good Messiah.
Yeah, now it... Yeah. This is sweet, because it links not just by setting back to Cana, but how else does it link to Cana? The end of this passage... This is now the second sign. Where was the first sign? Cana. So you see there's something. This is when I talked before about this highly layered, beautifully textured book that John has given us. There's so many links. And guys, the more you read John, for example, the more frustrating it's going to be, because you want to bring all of this to your sermon, and you cannot. You've got to make choices in order to faithfully represent the primary claim. The content and intent of this passage controls the content and intent of my sermon, even though, boy, there's a wonderful opportunity for me to do something here that's going to make me look clever. So, got to be careful. I said one more, but one more.
You'll hear sometimes people will preach through the Gospel of John in 3 years or 5 years.
Yeah.
Obviously, you have to break up a passage like this.
Yeah.
Is that disingenuous?
Tomorrow, late in the morning, we're going to have a Q&A time. Bring that question tomorrow. Okay? Don't forget. It's going to connect to some other things that we'll want to talk about. All right, I'm going to try to wrap this up in 5 minutes, which will leave us 5 minutes for Q&A. Okay? This is more kind of pastoral instruction, help. Remember I told you I was going to give you a warning? Here it is. This is a very useful tool, but it's not the only tool. It's not even the only tool with narrative. Sometimes when we learn a tool like this, we can be very tempted to apply it all the time. You know, it's the old, when you got a hammer, everything looks like a nail. You got to test it to see if, in fact, this is the dominant structure of your passage, because it's not the only way that an author can develop narrative texts, through a plot line. So you've got to ask the question, are there other tools that access the structure better than the narrative arc? You've got to have a few more tools in your belt. You're simply asking the question, what is actually happening structurally in my passage? Instead of going in with a tool, you're looking at your text and you're asking, what is actually happening structurally in this passage? How really does the author organize his passage? So, let me just help you out here. Another tool. I'm just going to rip through some things here to give you. I wish we had time to do an exercise on every one of these, but I want to help you by filling out your tool belt. Sometimes another tool is just paying attention to the shifts in scene. So in narrative, time markers, place markers. You pay attention to those shifts, and now you'd simply block those scenes. Narrative proceeds episodically. Identify the episodes. So very often in narrative passages, scenes with clear markers of time and place, you block those scenes. It might actually be a better way to describe the structure than forcing this. It may be a better tool to reveal the emphasis of your text. I'm going to give you a hint. One of your passages coming up in Mark, it's far more useful to describe the scenes than to lay this plot line on top of it. Why? What are you doing? You're paying attention to how the author, you don't own the text. He owns the text. So you got to pay attention to how he organized it, not how you want to do it with some little tool that you learned at Simeon Trust. So the point is to look for different structural clues. Test out a few. I'm arguing there will be a dominating structure, and you can detect it. There is something that organizes the passage. What other kinds of things might we look for in narrative? Parallels. Mark loves to stack things. You got to pay attention to succeeding passages. Don't just take them by themselves. Ask, why did Mark stack this on top of this on top of this? Let me give you a quick example. You preach at the end of chapter 4, the calming of the sea, and then you get to the beginning of chapter 5, and you have, where am I? In the wrong gospel, in Mark. chapter 4, the end of chapter 4, Jesus calmed the sea. The beginning of chapter 5, the healing of the demoniac. Middle of chapter 5, you've got the healing of the woman. And then inside of that, Jairus' daughter. So you got four successive miracles. You could preach each one of those on their own. They're units. But is Mark actually doing something to tell you that, oh, my real unit is these four miracle stories together? Because there's something here in these four together that I'm trying to communicate that any one of them by themselves won't communicate. Like, for example, in every one of these cases, you've got some ancient enemy of man against which there's been attempts to solve. You've got seasoned sailors who are afraid. You've got a demoniac who no one has been able to chain. You've got a woman who spent all her money on the doctors and no one could heal her. And you got a woman, it's too late, Jesus. She's dead. Do you see what's happening in the putting together of those four? Now there's something more than just Jesus has power over this, this, or this. All of the ancient enemies of man are there. And with a word, in every one of those four miracles, with a word, Jesus says, and it's different. Now, that's a structural thing you got to pay attention to that you won't notice if you didn't notice the stacking, the paralleling, the paying attention to, the stress of each of those miracles. Pay attention to contrasts and comparison, especially between characters. How is that rich young ruler like the disciples? How is he unlike the disciples? How is that blind man that got healed the way he got healed like the disciples? How is he unlike the disciples? You see, there's passages that don't seem to have anything to do with each other, put right next to each other for a reason. And so you got to pay attention to comparisons and contrasts. Pay attention to interruptions and resumptions. Why does Mark do this sandwich thing? Where in the middle of the healing of the woman, he introduces this healing, or the healing of the dead girl, he introduces this healing of this woman. Why does he do that? That's a structural thing Mark's doing. Why is he doing that? Oh, and why is he doing that in the third and fourth miracle after 1, 2, and 3? Does that, in fact, heighten and tell you as a reader, all this stuff goes together? So you see the kinds of things that show up in narrative. It's not just this, guys. Don't keep pounding this on everything. Pay attention to other structural cues. Ask the question, how is my author structuring this? And how does that reveal emphasis? All right. Three concluding remarks. If you've got questions, we can bring them to our Q&A time tomorrow. Three concluding remarks. Number one, structure is not the thing you're ultimately after. You're describing the development to help you see the emphasis. Does that make sense? We can get so caught up with our exegetical observations, and then they end up getting into our sermon like everybody out there is interested in the structure of the passage. Structure is not what you're after. It's the idea, the concept, the claim of the text, the emphasis. Structure, both in writing and in reading, is a servant to the idea. Idea is king. Claim is king. That's what you're after. So structure serves the author in his writing. Structure serves the exegete in your understanding, but structure is designed to help you get something, a much bigger payoff. Comment two. Structure, I've already touched this, but I want to hit it again. Structure exists on multiple levels. So don't be confused that you've identified this unit, and it has something to do with the unit that went before and after, because there's a larger unit. And that's part of a larger unit called the Gospel of Mark. So recognize that structure exists on multiple levels. You got the macro structure of the book, and then you got formal structure, which helps you to identify units, and then you have material structure within your unit like repetitions and parallels and that kind of stuff. So don't think that structure is just one thing that exists on one level. It's multi-leveled. By the way, I think structure in the Gospel of Mark is going to be one of your best tools. Mark is a highly structured book. So this is a tool you're going to find very useful. Number three, there is often a correspondence between your exegetical structure. In other words, when you do that second step and you describe the development of your passage, that's an exegetical work you just did. There is often a correspondence between your exegetical structure and your homiletical structure, but don't let that be slavish. In other words, this should not be your homiletical outline. Setting, rising action, climax, resolution, new setting. That's a terrible homiletical outline. When it comes to identifying the primary claim of your text, there should be a one-to-one correspondence between that and the primary claim of your sermon. That's a place where we will push you hard and say, the point of the passage should be the point of your sermon. The content and intent of your text should control the content and intent of your sermon, which shows up in your proposition. But when it comes to structure, there's a less necessary connection between the structure, your exegetically described structure, and your homiletically executed structure. It's more important that you find a structure that effectively carries the burden that your structural analysis reveals. Did you follow that? It's more important that you find a homiletical structure that faithfully carries the emphasis that your structural analysis revealed. So, just to help you out, when preaching narrative, I typically don't find myself reflecting the exegetical outline. I do something like this a lot. A spa. I retell the story, I focus the point, and I apply the text to the audience. That's a very different homiletical outline than this, but is it a faithful vehicle that communicates what I discovered in my exegetical description?